Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. On September the 1st, the Pentagon issued its annual report on the Chinese military, and joining us to discuss it are Randy Shriver, until late last year, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Indo-Pacific Security Affairs in the Trump administration, who's now with the Pacific Solutions Consultancy and is also the chairman of the Project 2049 Institute that aims to help formally normalize relations between the United States and Taiwan, and Dr. Patrick Cronin, the Asia-Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute think tank. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Really delighted to be with you both and talk about something that I've worked on in the past, and now I'm just another observer on the outside.
Vago, I'm delighted to be here with both of you.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Randy, let me start with you, because until very recently, you were in the department and obviously worked on a couple of these reports. Obviously, this is an intelligence community product, but this is also the 20th anniversary edition of the Pentagon's annual Chinese military power report. It mirrors Soviet military power, if everybody from the Cold War generation remembers. And it was a document that was launched at a very different time, right? China, there was a lot of optimism about the relationship. Beijing was entering the World Trade Organization. There was an expectation the country would become more free and open as it got richer. Instead, it channeled its wealth into raw military power, economic might, diplomatic leverage worldwide, extorting technology and concessions from companies seeking to do business in its borders, actually projecting its power externally, industrially, to force concessions, for example, trying to help isolate increasingly Taiwan, and then, of course, some of the specific military capabilities to counter U.S. Capabilities. Randy, you know, start us off. What are the key takeaways in this report from your perspective?
I think the key takeaways, Vago, that China continues to invest heavily, continues to improve capabilities across a broad spectrum, and that their ambitions are beyond just the near abroad, beyond sovereignty, what they consider sovereignty issues, but are more global in nature, and they're on the move. I think that's my basic takeaway, and I think the report is extremely comprehensive and does a good job of describing where these investments are going and where they're paying off in terms of real capability.
And I should point out to the audience, this is a 200-page report, and it is very, very methodical in breaking down everything from civil-military fusion, how society supports the public People's Liberation Army, talent recruitment, talent management, before even you get to all of the technological capabilities, obviously, that China is bringing to bear. Patrick, what were your takeaways as somebody seasoned at reading and interpreting these sort of intelligence community, but as well as important political documents?
Well, it's hard to generalize about 200 pages, but I certainly agree with Randy that the stark message here is that look how much the PLA has done in the past two decades to catch up and in some cases even equal or surpass U.S. capabilities. And subliminally, where might they be going over the next three decades as they head toward mid-century and the idea of becoming this world-class military that China's never really defined? Now, the most striking sort of element of the entire report for me is the progress they're making now toward 2035 and becoming this modern, informationized sort of joint warfighting capability. And the science and technology that's threaded through all parts of their sort of restructuring in terms of the strategic support force, if you will, with the new domains being integrated with psychological warfare into space, cyber, and electronic warfare. They have a section in this report, which I really commend reading, which they call, it's just one page, Emerging Military Campaign Concepts. Some very interesting phrases there, including information superiority at great distances. You know, when you think about what that means, that's global information superiority. There's a lot packed into that phrase. And let's just sort of look at the real world this week, Vago. What is Foreign Minister Wang Yi talking about? He's talking about a brand new global initiative on data security. Now, these are the China cyber rules that China's trying to sell to the world to protect so-called data sovereignty and sort of ban the installation of backdoors and technology and so on, things that are favorable to the Chinese technology companies and champions and to the security and military of the PLA at our expense over the long term. So you've got to look at this document as sort of a snapshot of 2020 with China trying to head over the next 15 to 25 years toward information superiority as being a dominant theme, I think, out of this sort of report.
And I think we saw a counter to that with Dr. Esper announcing that, for example, U.S. artificial intelligence efforts are going to be brought, you know, are going to be expanded, and we're going to be inviting some of our closest allies to work in that space. Randy, do you want to add anything more broadly to sort of follow up on some of Patrick's points in terms of some of the specific military capabilities that are in the report that you, as somebody who's devoted your you know, much of your career to certainly the area, and of course being a former early in your career naval intel officer, you know, sort of the some of the specific discrete elements that maybe jumped out at you as well?
Yeah, I agree with everything Patrick laid out. I would foot stomp, I guess, the issue of military civil fusion, which Patrick mentioned. It's quite an aggressive, robust effort to basically leverage what passes for a private sector, but basically Chinese companies, whole of society, really, effort to improve the PLA and meet their goal of becoming a world-class military. And so, you know, people have talked about military-civil fusion for a while, but this is an effort to really explain it to key constituencies, the public, the Congress, why we should be paying attention to this and why a comprehensive effort on their part is going to require a comprehensive response on our part, not just export controls, but cybersecurity and the like. So I paid particular attention to that section.
Let me ask both of you for a take as to whether this report is as alarming as it should be. I was talking to a retired military friend of mine who worked at a senior staff level who was very familiar with IC products. And he said, you know, this is a report where the analysts did a great job. And then the political leadership, which is its purview, sort of dialed it down. So he sort of defined it as a somewhat tortured report. That if you, and my, our contributing editor, Chris Cavas, has sort of astutely made this point before, that when you would read the old annual Soviet military power reports, they were designed to publicly detail capabilities in order to raise sufficient alarm to build congressional, public, and allied support for strategies and programs and the spending needed to realize them. There's a concern in this case that sometimes when you talk to senior U.S. military folks, they don't really discuss Chinese capabilities ever, and they decline to do so. And they're like, well, the people who know, and we don't have to discuss them more broadly. And then that raises the issue of, well, wait a minute, are they so bad we don't know how to counter them? If you're trying to build support for this, bipartisan or otherwise, wouldn't you want to discuss the thing that we need to have urgency about to resolve? Is that a deliberate choice? Is there a reluctance to honestly discuss the threat? And if not, why not? And if so, isn't that what we need to do to get the kind of urgency that we had, for example, during the Cold War? Randy, if you want to start us off, and Patrick, get your take.
I think it's a little bit unfair to say that it's watered down or toned down a bit. I think there's a couple things here. First of all, the history of this report, this is the 20th anniversary, is very different. Actually, the Congress was the one who asked for it and put it in the NDAA because they were afraid at the time of the Clinton administration, which I was serving in, was maybe pursuing engagement for engagement's sake and was maybe at that time downplaying some of the capabilities. And so the initial reports were really just, if you remember the old show, Joe Friday, just the facts. Just give Congress what they've asked for, literally, right, to the letter. Don't give them anything more. And I think the report has really evolved. I mean, when I was serving as the assistant secretary, we saw the report as an opportunity, not just a requirement to meet a congressional demand, but an opportunity to do the public education, congressional education. And we started adding special sections that the Congress didn't ask for. Last year, we talked about the strategic support forces. We talked about the Arctic as a growing area of interest for China. This year, there's additional special sections. So I think it's, you know, the history's a little bit different, and that probably created an evolutionary process. So we're not quite where the Soviet military power report was even now. But I think it does a good job of still, in a comprehensive way, laying out the trajectory of growing capabilities and why they should be concerning to us.
Patrick?
Well, Vago, I certainly agree with what Randy just said. I mean, we are an open democracy, but we are giving 200 pages of data about one of the most sensitive aspects of China's power, their People's Liberation Army writ large. So I don't think we're holding back as a government. In fact, just the opposite. I think it's a very forthcoming report. It's a definitive, authoritative report. Is it cautious on some of the judgments? Sure. Are some of the phrases sort of more diplomatic than you would want? You might want to argue? Of course, for instance, indeed, on the military-to-military engagement, the first talking point and the key points is how beneficial they are, but it doesn't talk about some of the potential downsides. Okay, well, we know that. But this is data-rich, and when it has phrases like describing how much China is working toward intelligentized warfare, where they're bringing in artificial intelligence to create a faster OODA loop, I think the classified version of this, and there's a classified version we haven't seen, must undoubtedly talk about, therefore, what are priorities for the United States government to consider resourcing and to worry about.
I want to get into a little bit of a discussion. I mean, clearly this administration has stepped up sort of across the piece urgency on how best to deal with China, although there is a sense that it's not as organized, perhaps, or everything is as aligned, perhaps, as it should be, right? That there were a lot of very, very good actions. DOD, you know, Randy, I think you drew high marks from all who looked at the job that you were trying to do in terms of engaging with allies and partners and trying to have the most sensible ramp up in strategy as part of a broader evolutionary approach for most of the political leadership in the nation, right? You know, we recently commemorated General Brent Scowcroft's passing. You know, at the time, I think his view was every other power that's gotten democratically, that's become more economically prosperous, has also become more democratic. A lot of folks couldn't envision how technology could be harnessed, especially over the last few years, for example, to lead to a more repressive and authoritarian state in contrast. And also sort of a reluctance for people to sort of fully appreciate an adversary for what the adversary is. All you have to do is listen to Chinese writings and you would have known that. What is this administration doing right? And what's the administration doing wrong? You know, and sort of how does a new Trump administration or a new Biden administration need to look at the challenge and the actions that it's got to take? And Randy, let's start with you, and then Patrick would love to get your sense.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment about if you just read what the Chinese had been writing for a long time, because that's something else I've devoted a big part of my career to. And we like to say the first line of encryption for the Chinese is Chinese. And if you just read what they're writing, they'll tell you an awful lot about what their aspirations and ambitions are. But look, I think one of the things the Trump administration should get credit for is really reorienting our view and our posture vis-a-vis China, being very explicit that it's a strategic competitor, being very explicit that it's the top priority, not one of many priorities, not a priority, but the top priority, and that through the implementation of the NDS, starting to resource the DoD enterprise in the right ways to deal with China. That's lethality of the force, more capability that's responding to China as the pacing threat. That's partners and allies, and that's resourcing. I'm an advocate for the Pacific Defense initiative, Pacific Deterrence Initiative, excuse me, that would be similar to EDI in that it would really bound the administration to commit resources to the effort. But irrespective of that, for the time being, at least, this administration is focused on the right thing and is resourcing in the right ways. You know, I think there's a lot of criticism out there about various aspects of the policy, some of which is unfair, some of which might be more fair. I think we were slow on the trade and economic side to get our act together in the Trump administration. We did a repeal but not a replace when we left TPP, and slowly but surely the replace is coming in the form of bilateral trade deals, in the form of the Build Act, but it was slow, and I think that set us back. And I think also our management of partners and allies, as much as, you know, I put effort into that, my team, others in the administration, we probably could have done better there too.
And do you think that it's a good idea to keep pressing ahead, for example, on Japan and South Korea basing payments? I mean, we now hear the $8 billion figure. I mean, obviously, the countries had balked at five, so eight is probably going to be a taller lift. Is that something that hurts us, or over the long term hurts us?
Yeah, I mean, my view is we've had a reasonable agreement in the past that was mutually beneficial. And we should be able to arrive at that again. And I think my own view is we should be thinking more strategically about these relationships and not thinking about it as purely transactional and what level of payment we can get for our forces being there to help protect them.
Patrick?
One of the things that the Chinese are saying, and it's indicated in this report out of DOD, is that they see the United States as being more willing to confront China, which is interesting because this is what we often say about the Chinese, that Xi Jinping is much more confrontational and willing to take risk, which is also true and preceded the Trump administration's sort of attempt to try to have more reciprocity. But in that confrontation, backed by significant hard power, the United States has been less adroit at soft power, at alliance management and economic instruments of power. Randy just basically said as much in different ways. And by the way, I should add that Randy was one of the best assistant secretaries we've had that I can remember in my lifetime, because he was actively working both the challenges and the opportunities for U.S. national security. The next administration, if it's a Biden administration and it's trying to differentiate more than Trump does, at least publicly, the Trump administration does publicly on China, for instance, it doesn't make it its number one priority. It makes it one of a list of priorities. You have to then recognize that China will adjust its tactics to exploit that, just as they're exploiting their tactics right now to try to address the Trump administration's singular focus on China. So the U.S. is being called, as we were at the ASEAN Regional Forum in Vietnam this week by Foreign Minister Wang Yi, the most sort of destabilizing force in the Indo-Pacific. Now, this has been a talking point for some time. It'll probably continue even if there's a Biden administration. But we can expect China not to change its strategy. Xi Jinping seems to have set his strategy and his sights on a pretty long-term ambitions. But they would certainly adjust their tactics. So no matter who is in office in 2021 and beyond in the United States, we're going to have to be more agile at trying to realize we're playing a comprehensive sort of game. One other point I would just make is, and it's one thing that's missing in the report, partly because of the timeline, there's very little really about the move into the Middle East that China's making. And here I'm thinking about this proposed 25-year deal, $400 billion investment into it with Iran. And whether this comes to pass next March or not, which is when it might be signed, the whole idea of what China could be doing with replicating bases, JASC port right at the Strait of Hormuz, to sort of emulate what they've got in Djibouti outside, the Red Sea. This is something that the next administration is going to be dealing with, not just the Indo-Pacific narrowly, but really a much more global reach by China.
I couldn't agree with you more, right? I mean, if, you know, China has to be a priority and something which I believe, you know, it's fortunate to try, you know, C.Q. Brown is the new chief of staff of the United States Air Force. He wants there to be greater urgency in the fielding of new capabilities. Obviously, you would expect that from a former Pacific Air Forces commander. And this sort of concern that people have that, you know, it's great we're talking about China, but to try to get that right kind of focus across the board, diplomatic, economic, military, informational, right? I mean, there's a very important information campaign to be fought here as well, where the United States is and its allies are sort of the good guys, and China to be sort of evidenced for the problematic actor that it is. Speaking about problematic actor, so now that Hong Kong has effectively fallen, there are a lot of folks who are basically concluded this is not worth making an issue because it's only a question of 27 years before which, you know, Hong Kong would not be sort of one nation, two systems, but one nation, one system. But there is a concern that now that China has successfully put Hong Kong to heel, that its next move is going to be on Taiwan, which it has made very, very clear it will not accept as a breakaway province. Randy, your organization advocates the normalization, full normalization of relations with Taiwan. You were in Taipei earlier this year. How real is the threat? And if it is real, what should nations be doing to prevent China from miscalculating in Taiwan, which is what some people fear?
The threat is growing because of growing capabilities and a sustained focus on a Taiwan contingency. I think the risks are becoming greater. But I think there's a lot that the United States can do as a partner to Taiwan and perhaps other countries can do as well. And I wouldn't put it just in the military realm. My priority would be a free trade agreement or some type of enhanced trade agreement with Taiwan, because of course Taiwan faces not only military pressure but economic coercion and pressure. But I think there's a lot more we can do. We can do clarity on our policy. Richard Haass just came out with a piece talking about strategic clarity as opposed to traditional strategic ambiguity. And I think that's a helpful direction to move in, given the growing threat, so that we can start to remove some of the doubt in the minds of the Chinese about what kind of challenge they'd face if they tried to invade and take over the island. I think we're doing fine on arms sales, but you should be buying more of the right things: coastal missile defenses, short-range mobile surface-to-air missiles, ISR capabilities, for example, through UAVs. I mean, these things will help Taiwan enormously. Remember, 80 nautical miles of water, mountainous, inhospitable terrain is a pretty good place to start on the defense before you buy a single weapon system. And I still look at this and say, I'm not quite sure how the PLA is going to get hundreds of thousands of guys across the strait. The amphibious lift is not there. The airlift is not there. Mm-hmm. And it remains axiomatic. You got to have soldiers with rifles and bayonets holding ground and keeping ground in order to really exert your sovereignty over an otherwise unwilling populace. And I think that just remains the long pole in the tent that should give the PLA just enough doubt to say not today, not tomorrow, not next week. And if we could just extend that, I think Taiwan's survival will be sustained.
Do you think the Taiwan Relations Act should be rewritten to make it a lot more explicit? Because I think the United States has used that ambiguity. You know, I remember in the Bush administration, there was a lot of concern that China would take advantage of that ambiguity and then put the United States in a position to have to come to Taiwan's defense. Do you think that at this point needs to be rewritten? Because if you look at it, right, Taiwan is a model of a transition from a dictatorship to a thriving democracy and an open and very, very productive economy. If you look at, you know, Taiwan's response to COVID-19 and compare it to China or even the United States and Britain, it's really a shining global model.
Absolutely.
Do we need to rewrite the Taiwan Relations Act?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily advocate that. I think it's an empty vessel of sorts that gives you plenty of opportunity to expand the relationship and do the things you need to do. Patrick and I worked for a guy named Kurt Campbell, who all the way back in March 1996 said, you know, rather than strategic ambiguity, what we should have is strategic clarity and tactical ambiguity. And I kind of liked that then, and I think it's actually a very important concept now. The strategic clarity part, we should be willing to say it is in our interests, if not our strategic interests, for Taiwan's continued existence and survival in its current form or better. And it is not in our interest for Taiwan to be absorbed either through force or otherwise into a greater one China while the CCP is in power. Now, tactical ambiguity, you're always going to want to preserve some ambiguity as to how you respond in particular contingencies. You'll want that flexibility. I think the Congress, the American people would demand it, in fact. And in that regard, it's not that much different than most of our treaties, which leave a lot of room for tactical decision making in the event of an actual crisis or contingency. So I think the TRA is a platform that allows us to do all that. But we have to keep our eye on this ball because, as we said earlier, Vago, the threat is growing.
Patrick?
Randy makes great points on Taiwan. The strategic clarity is something that is being forced really on the United States as China becomes more assertive. You know, one of the things that the DoD report makes clear, as frankly all previous 19 reports made clear, was that Taiwan contingency is the most sensitive issue, the number one contingency for which the PLA prepares. And yet, I think Xi Jinping personally has unification with Taiwan as an inexorable part of the China dream that he sells. And that means there is a clash coming if the timelines sort of mix here. The one way to avoid the clash potentially is to make sure that we have enough clarity, that we don't let Chinese psychological operations disintegrate the enemy as they are want to try to do. That we show political will and support. One of the limitations on the United States that we have to be realistic about, though, Vago, is that our allies and partners around the world have less political will than we do. So however much political will we show, we'll be putting them on the spot. So I'm thinking of Europe, for instance, where there's been a profound sea change in views toward China in the last few months and years. China's really become seen as a very sort of malign actor of late. And this was shown on Wang Yi's visit, including to Norway, where he said, "Don't give the Nobel Prize to Hong Kong democracy protesters, or else." In effect, you just had the Czech Senate president go to Taiwan, and there was a pushback from Beijing on this issue. But the reality is that all our industrial democracies have a balancing act to do with this behemoth of an economy run by China. And so we're going to have to figure out ways to support Taiwan, strategic clarity, tactical ambiguity. That sounds like a good way to go with me. Randy was at the front lines, I think, these last 3 years of really trying to promote functional, serious ties that there would be no miscalculation, no mistake on the part of Beijing. So they couldn't pull off this sort of miraculous amphibious invasion or strangle Taiwan's democracy, but rather going to have to figure out a much more diplomatic way of trying to win friends and influence people in the long term. And that's what we can all live with.
I want to extend the broadcast just a couple of minutes to ask this question, because I think, Patrick, you put you hit the nail on the head. And this question goes to the both of you. How do we build the case with our allies and partners, and even the case domestically, that we should bear a greater price, that they should bear a greater price to counter China? If you talk about the economic influence, it's both overt in the terms of pressure, Patrick, as you said, you know, sort of going to Oslo and threatening Norwegians about the Nobel Prize. But it's also very, very subtle. If I type Taiwan, for example, into an Apple device, it doesn't capitalize Taiwan. And that's not like China that can be misunderstood for another word. That's either pressure from China or Apple wanting to placate China that causes that. What's the right case everybody should be making, that it's in their interest to drive change in China through a concerted global campaign, which means incurring pain, because China's model has been nobody is willing to incur the kind of pain we will expose them to, whether on Taiwan or anything else, right? I mean, it's only why, what, six countries have diplomatic relations with Taiwan, because China has put so much pressure on them. Randy, I think you and I were at a Singapore air show where the Singaporean authorities allowed, you know, forced Taiwan to change its name, blanked out all the Taiwanese flags. And this is a country that's a military ally of Singapore, where its army gets trained. So Patrick, why don't you start us off and then Randy finish it up on what's the sort of global campaign that's necessary to get people to understand and be willing to bear the price necessary in order to try to drive change?
Well, Vago, I think the world is waking up. The United States has only recently woken up in some ways to the challenge that China poses, but we have to make sure we're dealing with a serious understanding of that challenge and not a caricature of it, because it's easy to kind of take extremes and not look at it in the round. I think our allies and partners are waking up. As I mentioned, there's been a profound change in Europe. There's been obviously a change over the past decade in Asia Pacific. And as China gets more active in places like the Middle East, I think there'll be changes there as well. So the first thing is to work with the interests of our allies and partners, and to recognize that they have true interests at stake. So for instance, if we're pressing allies and partners on 5G technology, telecommunications technology, then we have to be willing to do more to provide alternatives, to build that trusted network out. We're starting to do that, but we've been slow to this game of providing alternatives on the economic front. We have to recognize that diplomacy and words matter if we're going to be persuasive. And so even though it takes a lot of effort, there's a reason why we had, before COVID, you know, Assistant Secretary Randy Shriver go to so many meetings and to make statements in places that people in Washington were not paying attention to, but the region was listening to, because that's what persuades your partners and allies that the United States has your interests in mind, that you share those interests, that you now have a common view of the situation, and the Americans are going to come with some solutions, not just a price tag of saying, you know, pay. So I think all of the components of effective persuasion and building out, especially the industrial democracies, where it's so obvious that, as the European Union now says, China poses a systemic rivalry. So one of the things that Wang Yi, or no, Xi Jinping rather, will bring up again in his telephone call, Zoom chat summit, if you will, with Chancellor Merkel later this month, is to try to get Germany to oppose this idea that Europe is locked in a systemic rivalry with China, and also not to join the other European countries that are increasingly waking up to the 5G threat that China poses. And that's the kind of battle that we have to be willing to wage diplomatically, economically, as well as militarily and informationally.
One of the unfortunate things that I would pick up from European friends is, Vago, you guys are doing this because you don't want us, you know, you want to force us to buy much more expensive American 5G equipment as opposed to it being kind of the security threat. Although I think over time that's ameliorated, and I think folks understand the security threat element of it. Randy, if I can give you the last word, you know, what's the right way for the United States to be making this case that it's worth bearing the cost of countering China, and to make that cost and make that argument even domestically in the United States, but not to do it in a blunt force way, because there is a concern that some of this, you know, I mean, as Eric Sayers points out, right, I don't really care where my lawn furniture or my sewing, you know, there are a lot of things I don't care whether they're made in China, whereas there's a whole bunch of stuff that actually we can and should care that are made in China.
Yeah. Well, I'm a fan of letting the Chinese make the case for us, as they often do. when they threatened to cut off pharmaceuticals after the outbreak of COVID-19, when they threatened Japan with a cutoff of rare earths, which in fact threatened global supply chains. You know, they do an awful lot to reveal their ambitions and the lengths to which they'll go to try to meet their objectives. And so when we talk about the integrity of our supply chains, the integrity of our communications, and our continuing interest in having secure communications with allies, the Chinese have put enough out there themselves to make the case. And we just have to harvest that and leverage that and keep the conversation going. I do see the direction as a positive one, with European friends and partners and allies in the Indo-Pacific region. And maybe that's just having some perspective. When Patrick and I worked in the Pentagon in the 90s, and then even into the Bush administration when I was at State Department, you know, we were fighting with the Europeans for them not to lift their arms embargo, if you remember.
Right.
Chirac and Schrader were very interested in lifting the arms embargo. So we're talking now about, you know, telecommunications infrastructure and where the sort of line should be drawn. That's a much more mature, advanced conversation. And I think it's continues to move in a good direction from my perspective.
And if I can, Randy, ask you 30 seconds, you know, the United States, after 19 years of war, here we are on the 19th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks that precipitated a global campaign against terrorism that's been ongoing, invisible to most Americans, although I think everybody sees Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, but obviously Libya and so many other campaigns around the world as part of this. Are you convinced that the American people would support a U.S. Military operation to support Taiwan? I mean, is that something that would be embraced, problematic? Are we doing enough to convince people the importance of having to do that if necessary? Or is this, as so many people tell me, Vago, there's no way the American people should sacrifice themselves to protect Taiwan against China? You know, that's something for those two countries to sort out. I mean, what's the case? Is there a case that should be a bigger case that needs to be made to convince people that if necessary, that's something that the United States can and must do?
Yeah, I think we need to continue to make the case. And to me, Taiwan looks more and more like a modern day Fulda Gap in Asia, because how do you protect the free and open qualities of the Indo-Pacific if Taiwan falls? Just pull out your map and look at the implications through the first and second island chain. But look, to say the United States is not going to be there is a huge risk. Fact is, we've done something to support Taiwan in every crisis, every dust up they've had, and most recently the 1996 missile exercises where we sent two carriers. So to say an aberration is coming, I think is a risk for the Chinese to think that way. And you know, there's a pretty broad spectrum of the type of support. I think if you're talking about flowing tens of thousands, divisions into Taiwan, that may be something that the American people would have difficulty with, but there's certainly a lot of things we can do that are passive and less visible. Intelligence ISR support, complicating Chinese ISR to things that are more visible and less kinetic, and pardon me, non-kinetic, like logistics support and the like. Or we can do certain kinetic things where we have a comparative advantage over the Taiwanese, things they can't do for themselves. So keep that in mind as well. This, to say we're just going to abandon Taiwan, I don't think is likely. And I think the PRC needs to keep that in mind.
Patrick, any parting thought? I don't want to leave you on the sidelines because you normally have something valuable to add.
I agree with Randy Shriver. We're going to support Taiwan.
Gentlemen, thanks very, very much. Always an honor and pleasure having you on. Randy, welcome back. Look forward to having you on more regularly. Patrick, thanks so much as always for making so much time available to us. Hope you guys stay well and look forward to having you back on again soon.
Thank you very much.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.